Hello, everybody. This is week 3 of Consciousness, the Web Course. This is Dr. Bernard Bars speaking for Dr. Katie McGovern, who can't be with us this time around, but she's always contributing to the content of the course behind the scenes. The topic for this week is the theater metaphor. That's the lecture topic. And the key idea that I would like you to know is this. There is limited conscious capacity, which we've noticed before based on last week's PLAB. That is to say, we can only handle so much consciously at any given moment. And the way we find that out is by looking at so-called dual tasks. Well, dual tasks are just an example of multitasking, which is what we do all the time in the age of the web. We are always trying to do more than one thing at a time, at least a lot of us. That may not be the wisest thing to do, but it's very tempting. And what we always find is that there are limits to our capacity for doing things wholeheartedly or wholeheadedly, if you want to use that term. Well, the limited conscious capacity is a very interesting phenomenon because it's so surprising. Imagine being an ancestor of ours on the African Serengeti, let's say a million years ago, or for that matter, 100,000 years ago when the Homo sapiens was already emerging. And suppose that you're trying to drink at a watering hole, which is what people had to do at that time, of course. They were hunter-gatherers, and they were crucially dependent, especially during droughts and so on water supplies. And as you know from your African wildlife movies, there are lots of creatures that go down to the watering holes, including lions and deer, and basically every living creature over there is dependent upon the water supply from the watering hole. Well, you bend down and you scoop up some water, and the moment you bend down to scoop up some water and drink, which you need to survive, there's all kinds of other things that could be happening. Your children could be drifting off into danger, because this is a very dangerous place. All the animals are there. Your competitors within your social group could be making eyes at the sexual competition. Your competitors in terms of power within the group might be making moves at the same time. There might be a little rustling in the grass beside you or behind you, and you don't have eyes in the back of your head, so you can only hear it, but you can't be looking all the time. There's a noise, so you have to be extremely aware of everything that's happening. The fact is that conscious limited capacity endangers your life. If you could do what is called true parallel processing, if you had eyes in the back of your head, you could survive better than you would. Now, there are ways of getting around that danger, that side effect of conscious limited capacity. For example, you can have friends who can look out for you, and that's what herd animals do. Herd animals look out for each other, so one of them will suddenly shy, and the rest of the herd starts running because they figure that that's an alarm signal, and there could be lions around. So there are some ways of dealing with conscious limited capacity. What I find startling is that evolution has not found ways of having more than one conscious stream going at a single time. Well, that's interesting. And that goes along with another aspect of limited capacity, which is kind of the opposite. And that is the gigantic unconscious capacity that we have every single moment of our lives, as long as we have brains that are functioning. And we can find evidence for the giant unconscious capacity for from at least four different sources, actually even more different sources of evidence. One of them is the sheer number of neurons in the human brain, which is enormous in proportion to our bodies. We use something like a third or a quarter of our energy intake to support this giant cortex that we have, which is really ballooned in comparison to our ancestors. It is now believed that the cortex has about 10 billion neurons. A few years ago, the standard estimate was about 100 billion neurons. And of course, we are constantly getting more detailed studies of cortex from the people who study the anatomy of the brain at the micro level. So I assume that the latest estimate is better than the previous estimate. Let's say we have 10 billion neurons in cortex. But we also know that most of cortex, or most of the brain volume, is taken up by white matter. And the white matter consists of connections. All those are wires, if you like, and they're covered with a white material that's called myelin. And myelin basically consists of support cells which wrap around neurons, or rather the axons of neurons, and the support cells are colored white. So if you look at it with the naked eye, what you basically see is this gigantic amount of white matter in the brain. Well, why are there so many neurons, 10 billion, and so many connections? Because the connections, of course, are even more numerous than the neurons themselves. You get huge, what is called combinatorics, in the interaction between different parts of the brain, just like you might on the web, for example. The World Wide Web is actually a pretty good metaphor for the brain, because we know that the brain, that the World Wide Web involves a huge number of potential connections. The fact that you and I can connect right now, of course, is indicative, because we are just a few people out of the millions and millions of people who have ready access to the web right now. And yet, you and I can connect in a one-to-one fashion and communicate a lot of information back and forth. The same thing is true about the core brain, which is often called the thalamocortical system. And what that basically means is the cortex and the thalamus. And the reason why we include the thalamus is because the thalamus is the major input hub to the cortex. It is just the place that distributes a huge amount of information to the cortex, constantly. So we have these gigantic brains, mostly functioning unconsciously, of course. Let's say 99% unconscious, if those numbers mean anything, I'm not sure, but it gives you an impression. Most of what we do is unconscious, and yet we have this very narrow conscious capacity, and that creates a paradox. That's a oddity. The second source of evidence is the huge capacity of our long-term memories. And we normally, you and I, tend to complain about our memories, because when we take exams in school, we always feel that we don't quite know all the answers. Well, there's a trick to that, because school exams are designed usually to push human memory to the limits and beyond the normal limits so that we can discriminate between people. That's unfortunately how school exams and IQ tests and so on are designed. But if we look at a different way of testing human memory, namely recognition tests, we suddenly find out that we don't have such a bad memory after all. We have a hugely efficient and large memory. And we can do that by means of what are called recognition tests. Recognition tests are basically memory tests that ask the question, have you seen this before? Have you heard this before? And so on. And the answer is basically yes or no. And it turns out that people are enormously efficient at that particular test of human memory. So that I can ask you about the first class you had in first grade and what your teacher looked like and what some of the other kids in the class were like and perhaps some of the stuff that you'd learned. And if I simply present you with the class picture, for example, from the first grade, which might have been 10 years ago or 20 or 30, 40 years ago, the tendency will be for you to be quite accurate. Now, that doesn't mean that we can all recall it. Recalling is harder than recognition. It does mean that our recognition capacity for those kinds of things is simply enormously good. And what that means is that it's in your head. The information is there, all right, but you have to get it out in a certain way. And the best way to get that out is by presenting people with some actual information from the previous life event. Another way of looking at that is to show you an old movie that you might not have seen for years and simply ask you, have you seen this before or haven't you seen this? And very often you'll be able to say, aha, yes, I have seen it before, and I can even tell you what's in the next scene. That's an enormous memory capacity that human beings have. That's on the order of the kind of memory capacity that great libraries have, or Google Books, or one of those kinds of things. The third indication of the size of our mind brains is the size of our working vocabulary. Now, educated people have a recognition vocabulary of about 100 to 2,000 words. A lot of those words have multiple meanings, so that we have 300,000 or 400,000 meaning chunks in our head. That is to say, meanings that are established meanings. Any single word has a huge amount, or may have a huge amount, of information contained in it. For example, the word mother may have a huge amount of information for you, or the word father, or brother, or sister, so on. Those kinds of things, in fact, we think of them as single chunks of information, but they engage an entire brain network of related material. And of course, most of that network is unconscious at any given time. Right now, until I mentioned the word mother, you probably weren't thinking of it. Okay, so we have the huge size of the vocabulary. We have the number of conscious events that have happened to us and which we can access through recognition tests. We have the number of neurons and connections in cortex and thalamus. And finally, a fourth source of evidence about the huge size of the unconscious is the number of things that we do automatically. Now, every time you say a word, your mouth moves in ways that you do not know how to make conscious, just like my mouth is doing right now, along with my entire vocal tract, which has the tongue and the uvula and the vocal cords and all, and the lungs and all that sort of thing, all working together. All of that stuff, almost all of it, is unconscious most of the time. If you bite your tongue and it hurts, you might feel your tongue move around. But that's an unusual situation that usually happens when things go wrong. Most of the time, our actions and our perception and our thinking is very heavily driven by what are called automatisms or automatic components of action and perception and thought. That's a a very large domain of unconscious processes. And this is not even talking about things like the Freudian unconscious or other views of the unconscious that we would need to talk about separately. So the paradox, to go back to our main topic, is that we have this very narrow conscious capacity at any moment, along with this humongous unconscious capacity. And the usefulness of the theater metaphor, which I want to talk about a little bit, is that it combines both of those. It combines the narrowness of consciousness with the vastness of unconscious processes. And in order to see that, I'd like you to look at your lecture for the week, which you can download from the web, and I might also send it by way of you send it, where we have a picture that one of our associates, Carl Carpenter, was nice enough to make for the web bulletin Science and Consciousness Review last year. And Carl is a very good artist and gave us this wonderful image of the theater. And as you can see, it has these purple chairs to represent the audience. It has a black screen to represent the stage. And it has a spotlight with a bright spot that's indicated in white. And the bright spot is the part of the stage that is lit up. And, of course, behind the scenes, as we have in theaters, real theaters, we have the director and the stage crew and the screenwriter and so on, or the playwright. All kinds of people who make it all work, but we never see them. Well, the key about this diagram is that there is only one conscious component on this diagram, namely the bright spot on the stage. Everything else is unconscious or maybe fringe conscious, semi-conscious at times. It changes because this bright spot changes very quickly. We believe about 10 times per second, roughly, is how often it moves from point to point. Well, so the spotlight, or the thing that controls the spotlight, we call attention, or selective attention is the useful term that has been around for about 50 years. Selective attention is basically the little person who controls the direction of the spotlight. The bright spot itself is the contents of consciousness, which of course has limited capacity. The folks behind the screen who are making it all happen, who are guiding it, are unconscious, and the people in the audience who are receiving the information are also unconscious. They are very intelligent. They take in information. They can potentially interact, maybe by voting on what they like to see inside of the spotlight of consciousness, or the bright spot of consciousness, I should say. They can influence it, but basically they're taking information and using it locally for their own purposes. For example, one function of audience members is to update their knowledge of the world. So you might have an audience member that has to do with keeping track of your spatial location. That's largely unconscious. There is another audience member that has to do with keeping track of the body space around you. And we know that that one is located in a place called the parietal cortex, and so on. There are just hundreds and hundreds of highly specialized functions that are mostly unconscious. All the automatisms that we mentioned previously are unconscious under normal circumstances. Some of them are involved with motor control. We now know that a lot of them are involved with what's called the mirror system, which is basically our ability to imitate when we see somebody do something, we have a tendency to spontaneously imitate it, because there's lots of neurons in our cortex that are repeating what they see, pretending to be the person that we're looking at. That is probably why a baby, if you stick your tongue out at a baby, the baby's tongue will start to come out in about 20, 30 seconds. It's a fun thing to do if you have a little baby. And it's a very nice thing to do, too, because the baby likes it. So this is our theater metaphor. And as those of you who know about the history of these things know, this is a very old metaphor for talking about consciousness. In Western philosophy, it's associated with Plato's metaphor of the cave, but it also exists in Vedanta, I understand. And of course, and Aristotle also used it. Many other people have referred to it in the history of Western thought, and I'm sure in the history of Asian thought as well. And of course, elsewhere in the world, where there is no written tradition and we don't really know what people were thinking 1,000 years ago, it's very likely that people discovered and rediscovered the same kind of metaphor. So we're not claiming originality about this. We are claiming and able to claim at this point that theaters do things that are computationally very important for creatures like human beings. Theaters are technically called global workspace architectures, global workspace architectures. And people in the field of artificial intelligence have commonly used such computational theaters to accomplish tasks that robots needed to accomplish. The technical term is autonomous agents, that's to say, computational systems that need to go out and live in a world and achieve goals in a certain world. And that could be a computer virus, which achieves the goal of infecting your computer. That's not a very nice autonomous agent. Or it could be an actual robot, a physical robot. Or it could be a creature. It could be a mosquito. Or it could be a fruit fly. Or it could be a bee, because we know that bees have as much as 1 million neurons in their brains, and they do extremely functional things, extremely intelligent things. They have very good spatial location. They communicate to each other via the bees' dance. They interact with each other to keep the queen alive and to protect the hive and so on. So bees are very intelligent. They have lots of neurons, 1 million neurons is quite a few, and they do all kinds of intelligent things. Well, we've got 10 billion neurons in the cortex alone, and even more in the subcortex, and in the spinal cord, and in the peripheral nervous system. So we've got billions and billions and billions of neurons, all of them constantly doing things. Well, the theater metaphor is a useful way of thinking about all this. I would like you to understand the major empirical fact that we're talking about here, and I will repeat the empirical fact so that you can keep it in mind, and that's the paradox of conscious limited capacity and at the same time a very large unconscious capacity. The theater metaphor is only a metaphor. There's not a little theater inside of our heads. There is a system, it appears, there is a functional system in the brain that behaves very much like that. And that is why the theater metaphor is a useful thing to think about. It's also easy to visualize. You can keep Carl Carpenter's figure in mind if you would like to be able to visualize this And human beings are visual creatures, of course. We think visually very often. Keep in mind that the audience is unconscious, the stage is unconscious except for the bright spot, and everything going on backstage is also unconscious. And then one of the great questions today, of course, is a great scientific question, is, if there's a case to be made for that metaphor, then what is it in the brain that is actually going on? Because a metaphor is only a metaphor, and the brain has neurons and connections, basically. And we want to know how neurons and their connections could possibly rediscover a basic function like this theater or global workspace architecture. That's not the only theory, by the way, that's around to try to account for consciousness. It's a useful theory. It's a good thinking tool. It's one I encourage you to know. But there are other theories as well. And once we have a good grasp of the theater metaphor, we will talk about some of those other theories as well. As an announcement, I just want to mention to you that the upcoming issue of the Scientific American Journal will have a debate between two scientists interested in consciousness, Susan Greenfield from Britain and Christoph Koch, who is at Caltech and is originally from Germany. They are both very smart. Christoph Koch has been one of the leaders in the field for a number of years, working in the beginning with Francis Crick, who, as you know, was the co-discoverer of DNA and died just recently. Francis Crick spent, about the last 30 years of his life on the issue of consciousness and did a great deal to encourage research, that's good research on consciousness, and also to make it possible for scientists to get back to consciousness and to treat it as the fundamental question that it really is. So he was a great contributor. So this is the story for this week. I would like you to please understand those things, raise any questions you like during our discussions, debate things, be skeptical about it, challenge it, anything you like, of course, and we will discuss it online.